when you come to concurrent 1A, and it's labelled 1A, clearly it must be the best session of the conference. So welcome to concurrent 1A. We've got Jeff and Andrew today. My name's Ty Burkett. I'm with Willis Re. Global reinsurance, I spent a lot of time explaining to reinsurers there's a difference between motor and CTP in this country. And then I step into 8 different workers' comp schemes and 8 different CTP schemes. So we only have 40 minutes, but we've got Jeff and Andrew to talk through it. I was going to almost do the Jeff needs no introduction, but I better read the bio. Jeff has been consulting in general insurance since 1984. He's a principal at Affinity Consulting, the specialist insurance and actuarial firm. Jeff's experience covers a wide range of insurance issues in both public and private sectors, and he's been an advisor to many insurance and reinsurance companies and also to a number of CTP and workers' comp schemes in Australia and New Zealand. Jeff is ably assisted by Andrew, and Andrew is a principal at Affinity Consulting, specialising in workers' comp and personal injuries classes. Andrew must be a regular to Adelaide because it says here he has worked with Return to Work South Australia for over 10 years and is currently the South Australian Scheme Actuary. So what we'll do is I'll hand it to Jeff, who'll lead most of the discussion, and then we'll try and save some time for questions at the end. But over to Jeff.
Thanks, Ty, and good morning all. So this is pretty much down and dirty discussion about regulators in workers' comp and motor accident schemes. So I've put a bit of a challenge out here for anyone who's in a regulator role to think of themselves as the guardians of sustainability. So now that we've put that challenge out there, don't worry, because next year we're going to get on to peace in the Middle East, so we'll just knock this one over first. I do want to make a very quick apology. I was very poor in getting the material done on time, so there is nothing on the website. The PowerPoint is done. Thank you, Carmen, last evening. And there is a paper. It's only about 15 pages, but as soon as we get that into the compulsory institute format, that'll be up there as well. And if anybody's itching, I could just give them a copy. So, I'm just going to leave you to read that. That's a recipe for sustainability there for an accident compensation scheme, a little schematic that we've been using a little bit. And if you can get those half a dozen things lined up, you're in pretty good shape. So for the guardians of sustainability, how can you actually contribute to that? Okay, we'll move on to lunch, shall we? No, not quite. All right. So, brief outline, who are you, how do you get organised? I want to talk a bit about my favourite dispute resolution, the ever-present stakeholders and service providers, other roles, and a little bit on scheme culture. I hope we can leave enough time for that. So let's start with what is a regulator. Now, Andrew's my engineering colleague, so he's going to have to do this bit.
Playing to my background at science, actually, not engineering, but close. So this is not what I would consider a typical regulator definition that we see in this space. It actually comes from science. A subsystem or independent device that determines and maintains the operating parameters of a system, usually within certain prescribed or preset limits. So basically what we're trying to say is there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on behind the regulator, but what you're trying to manage is what comes out the other end. So that seemed to dovetail reasonably nicely with this concept of sustainability and actually keeping things operating within a certain set range.
Yeah, it's cool. I really like that. Did it for me. So a lot of people here will be from private sector and many obviously from public sector. For those of the private sector accustomed to financial services, there's financial services including insurance. You've got these three regulatory bits. You've got APRA and ASIC and ACCC. And I just want to do this briefly by way of comparison. So APRA is the prudential regulator, aimed to make sure the companies don't go broke. Now, we've got some regulators in state schemes that actually try and do that as well. And I'm just going to say, don't waste your time and money. Just leave that to APRA. You've got better things to do. Then ASIC does all the market conduct regulation. So that's products and services, how the insurance works, how the claims are handled, how the market participants interact. And so ASIC, for example, looks after the Insurance Contracts Act, the Financial Ombudsman, etc. So it's not intuitive for us actuaries, at least, but a scheme regulator is the equivalent of ASIC, not of APRA. As I said, even though that's not kind of intuitive, people talk a lot about APRA. Oh, can I just say about the prudential side, with the monopoly schemes, say underwritten schemes, the prudential regulator's got to be the State Treasury and Finance Department. I hope that's clear. Okay, then just a brief word about competition. The ACCC is the competition regulator for Australia. In financial services, ACCC doesn't really do anything except on a serious exception basis. So ASIC actually regulates competition in financial services, and so does an accident compensation scheme regulator deal with competition just as an integral part of that whole market conduct approach. Okay, let me move on. So, in a competitive market, it's probably just worth mentioning that that it'll be pretty obvious to all of you that the situation's different if you've got a competitively underwritten private insurance market or if you've got a monopoly public sector insurer. And we've got sort of more or less even spread around the country, so I'll just try and switch backwards and forwards and try and be clear about that. So if you've got a competitive market, the regulator is going to be a government agency. Very helpful if it has its own legal identity and its own staff and its own branding, because it's actually pretty important in the whole scheme of things. And the focus of that regulator, the scheme oversight and the stakeholder management, and I'll come into that in a bit more detail. So it's the insurers who are responsible for premiums and claims and all the customer interactions, not the scheme regulator. And if you're in a monopoly market, there's a pretty basic question about whether the quote scheme regulator is a separate entity from the insurer or whether it's part of the insurer. And this is an argument that sort of gets tossed backwards and forwards. In workers' comp, there we go, we've got two of each. We've got New South Wales, where the workers' comp regulator, brand new, mind you, is CIRA, the State Insurance Regulatory Authority, or a piece of CIRA. And we've got Queensland, where there's been a separate regulator for many years now. It was a separate legal entity as QComp, with its own board of directors. It's now a division of the Department of Business, et cetera, et cetera. And in Victoria and South Australia, we've got state schemes where WorkSafe is its own regulator and Return to Work, SA, is its own regulator. And I'll come on to some of the things about that that I think are a bit tricky. And if we look across our monopoly motor accident schemes, and other than three, all the Australian schemes are in that case, none of them have a separate regulator from the insurer. They're all the same people. So, again, I'll talk a little bit about the implications of that. So, governance, funding and staffing. Governance is over on the left. I'm a great believer in having a relatively traditional governance model with the regulator having its own board of directors, a small board, chosen for commercial skills, not for stakeholder representation, and this is an oversight board. It doesn't really make any decisions. It doesn't really have any authority of its own. The authority is vested in the regulator, not in the board of the regulator. Now, if you're in a situation like WorkSafe in Victoria is, or Return to Work South Australia, where I know them reasonably well, and Michael Francis is the head of their regulatory division, it's a bit tricky for him because his boss is the boss of the insurer. And when they deal with their board of directors, like most places, it's the CEO that has the primary role in dealing with the board of directors. So I just want to put out there that in that situation, it's not a bad idea to have one or a couple of the representatives of the board, people on the board, a regulatory committee, so that they take a special interest in the regulatory functions, and they'll have their own meetings with Michael, the head of the regulatory division. Because it's going to be pretty hard for him if he wants to disagree with his boss about something. That's a disadvantage of having it in the combined organisation, I think. Briefly on funding, as I think almost everybody is, keep it out of government budgets. You do your own funding from a little levy on the scheme. Firstly, it protects to a degree from political influence, another topic I'll come back to. And it basically gives the scheme controllers the opportunity to decide their own areas of where they're going to invest more or less, provided that governance structure's working okay. And staffing, I think it's self-evident with any organisation that having right people in the right roles is important. These government agencies will be governed by public sector employment conditions. That can be a bit tricky. Not just with pay, but with keeping specialist skills and career progression. But there's lots of very fine government organisations, government agencies around, so I don't think that really ought to be a showstopper for anyone. Personally, I'm a great fan of a bit of movement in and out between regulator and industry in that situation. Enough on that topic, huh?
You need to go quicker, Jeff.
Sorry?
You need to go quicker.
I need to go quicker. I knew that was going to happen. Any of you that know me know I just can't stop talking. Okay, disputes. I reckon one of the major functions of the scheme regulator is to be the dispute resolution system. So dispute resolution needs to be fast, it needs to be inexpensive, and it needs to be consistent. And the best way to achieve that and support sustainability is for the regulator to actually handle the vast majority of the disputes in an administrative framework. If you've got a regulator within the insurer, can't do it. Doesn't work. So in that case, you will have a separate dispute resolution entity, whether it's the courts or a separate tribunal, and that's actually more difficult to support sustainability because that organisation sees its interests purely in justice and doesn't have any brief for sustainability. So how do we do this? This resolution of disputes, it's an operational function. It's not a policy function. And I'm a great believer in it being inquisitorial. That's the Napoleonic system over there on the left that you can see, rather than adversarial, which is the Mike Tyson system. This thing's just lend itself to an administrative process. So you can deal with procedural fairness and you can deal with subject matter expertise. So you're getting the disputes handled by experts. The point there at the bottom of the slide, most of these accidents are not so complex that they need a court hearing to decide on the outcome, very occasionally. So this is pretty typical now. You've got an as-of-right internal review at the insurer, and the regulator has oversight of the way the insurer does that, not of the individual decisions, but of their systems and processes, because that's a really important part, and the more arguments or dissatisfaction you can hit off at that point, the better. And then the external review is the formal part. So the way I like to see this is as a administrative tribunal, albeit within the regulator's office, if that can work, a single registry, an intake officer that keeps the herd heading west, medical and legal or factual arms that are relatively strongly connected. We've made good progress in Australia with administrative systems like that, and we've had a lot of experimentation and a lot of knowledge learned about things that work better and worse, and there's a lot to be gained there. So what do? Quick and compulsory exchange of information. You get right in for a compulsory mediation. If that's not going to work, 2 weeks, you've got a hearing. There needs to be an appeal, on interests of national justice. So if it's a medical decision, there's a medical panel. If it's a legal or factual decision, it's the senior members of the tribunal. And then there's the red bit over there on escalation to court. So there are and will be important issues and novel issues that just need to be resolved by the courts. And I reckon the regulator should have no fear about pushing that up. In fact, I'd like to see most disputes referred to court with the regulator being heard as part of the case, and indeed promoting a lot of cases, you know, funding them. Because it's in everyone's interests to have some of these difficult questions sort of sorted and clear. And then you've got the dreaded judicial review, which I think's a more or less required part of administrative law. So that's where you can go to court on a point of law. I've seen a lot of these in, particularly they've been growing in New South Wales. And quite honestly, it's a stretch to see it as a point of law. It's just someone who didn't like the answer and they're going in on any adequate reasons or something like that. So if you've got a growing number of judicial reviews, that's actually a sign that the dispute system's not working. So that's where the regulator can twig and needs to take action at the place that's clearly not working so well. And the dispute resolution system is just as integral a part of this ecosystem as anything else, and it needs to be measured and people made accountable for its performance. So, you know, a regular assessment of the volumes and the timeframes, etc. Doesn't mean you keep track of who wins and loses, because that's not the essence of the dispute resolution system. Okay, how are we doing?
Don't worry, 18 minutes. Nearly 20.
Okay, stakeholders. Andrew and I knock this backwards and forwards, and there are two stakeholders in an insurance system. The people who pay the premiums, the employers and motorists, and the people who have the claims. Everyone else is a service provider, including me and a bunch of you, probably most of you. So what does the regulator have in terms of relationships? With the individual employers in a workers' scheme, not very much. Bit of information provision, bit of enforcement. It's the insurer. It's their job to deal with the employers. They're the ones that issue the policies and collect the premiums. You'll often have a premium appeal mechanism, light on. As far as the regulator dealing directly with the motorist is concerned, even less. Nearly nothing except for a bit of information and a little bit of navigation. There is simply no reason why the motor accident scheme regulator needs to ever have a sort of personal interaction with the motorist. And with the claimants, I'm a believer that that it's not their job to deal directly with claimants either, except in respect of the formal dispute resolution system, which is what that system's there for. But apart from that, it's the insurer's job to deal with the claimants. There's little point in sort of hearing complaints or ombudsman type things. You can keep your ear to the ground for systemic problems in an insurer, but trying for the regulator to intervene in individual customer complaints, probably not a good use of money. Did I say at the beginning that we were going to be opinionated here?
Please do.
Okay. Regulation of the service providers. This is the marshal here. That's Woody. He's my friend down there somewhere. So you've got all these disciplines in the service providers, right? You've got the acute care people, the hospitals. You've got primary and secondary care in medicine and allied health, rehab providers, lawyers, investigators, medico-legal experts. So it's a very long list. And what do you need to do? So we want to put up this idea of a significance test for the regulator in thinking about what they should be doing in stakeholder, service provider management. So if for this group of service providers, work for the compensation scheme's pretty minor in the scheme of things, leave them alone. They're not your problem. Influence them through their own professional body or other regulatory mechanism if needed, but they're not your problem. If, however, you've got a group of service providers for whom the compensation scheme is the bulk of their work, then you've got something serious to worry about. So that significance test, I think, is our way of suggesting a prioritisation when you've got this mass of different professionals living off the system and you're trying to figure out the best way to handle that. Oh, I pushed the wrong button, I'm sorry. So you've got a toolkit. You've actually got quite a big toolkit when you think through it. Not all available always depending on the law, but you know, you can read down there, practice guidelines, outlier responses, we've heard people talk about that, the peer practice reviews. That's been a learning in medical and allied health areas, much more effective than the regulator trying to come in telling people what to do, right down to enforcement, both professional enforcement and legal enforcement. It's a whole paper there in its own right. Now, what about with the insurers? Obviously, if you're in a competitive market, the regulatory environment with the insurers is fundamental. It's probably the most basic thing. You don't have any sanctions if an insurer is not being particularly helpful. What do you do? Threaten to take their license away. Solution's worse than the problem. And most of that work tends to be done sort of more by cajoling than anything else. So that makes it very tricky. And you get accused of industry capture, and that's a real thing. So one of the suggestions that we've put up there is a little bit of a more graduated set of sanctions that can be applied. And typically that's administrative fines and it's name and shame. And I tell you, from my knowledge of insurance companies, they hate name and shame. So that's a pretty powerful tool in the toolkit if you need to. If you've got a monopoly scheme using claim agents, what's the relationship between the regulator and the agent? Nothing. Nil. Because the agent is the arm of the insurer. And if the agent's not doing the right thing, that's the insurer's problem, not the regulator's problem. In workers' comp, of course, regulators do have relationships with self-insurers, and they are a prudential regulator there as well as a market conduct and authoriser. Suffice to say that we reckon no one is underdoing regulation of self-insurance. If anything, it's arguably a little overdone around the country, but that's under control. Okay, some other roles.
25.
Government relations, so important but so tough. How do you keep government away from daily interference and short-term political decision-making? Well, as I say here in the paper, this is a very short section of the paper. Easier said than done. So I'll move on from there, right? Making and interpreting rules. Government will make certain rules. I love to see the regulator having subsidiary rulemaking power. Gives you a lot more flexibility. And also I raise the question about whether you can do more in interpreting rules. So you can say, we've got this part of the law or part of a regulation. If people have raised a question, it might not be completely clear. This is how we think it should work. So you influence things that way. And then if you find that that doesn't work, then you've got authority to go and make a change. Much easier to make a change when you've demonstrated that you've tried something unsuccessfully than just bleating about how problematic it is. Premium regulation, again, a whole topic. Less is more is my kind of experience-based observation after many decades of to-ing and fro-ing. I reckon the West Australia Tassie workers' comp schemes have got it pretty good. They know what insurers are charging, and they publish data and suggested rates, which keeps the market relatively orderly. But it doesn't get in the way of competition. Andrew showed me a great graph a couple of days ago. West Australia, average over a very long period of time, insurance market's been charging on average 15% below the suggested rate. Very little up and down, in fact, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty stable.
Yeah. So that probably works pretty well. Prevention, I'm a bit of an outlier here. I'd rather see the workers' comp regulator separate from the work health and safety regulator, just because of focus. In motor accident prevention, TAC's done some great work, but outside that, I think the CTP, the Motor Accident Regulator, really just dumps in some money. Really, really nothing more than that. You know, we're talking about road builders and vehicle designers and coppers and so on. It's not really our field of expertise. You will always have an uninsured backup scheme. So nominal defendant, uninsured motorist. Don't try and run your own claims division for that. There's plenty of experts that you can use to handle that. But you're stuck with it. And also in an extreme circumstance, you've got an insolvent insurer scheme. Fortunately, nothing big since HIH, but people are still sort of living through the aftermath of that. Lastly, central statistical data, really important. I'm really impressed as an actuary. I think every person that spoke this morning, with the possible exception of one, said how important collecting and using data is in sort of evidence-based work. So, look, that's a real quick skim over a whole bunch of different topics. Anything to add, Andrew?
No, happy to take questions.
Have a chat.
Yeah. Okay.
Ha! You can talk about this.
Culture. One of our chestnuts. You can't legislate, but by God, it's important. And it really can influence how things are done. So a few of the comments this morning were around that design doesn't give you the outcome. It's the management and the culture and how things are done that kind of determines where you end up and potentially where you don't. It's something that needs to be tracked. How do you do that? Well, it's not through a precise measurement. You need to talk to people, you need to listen to people, and you need to open your mind to the views of a range of the different stakeholders and participants in the scheme. But by God, it's important, and when it goes wrong, it can really do damage.
Okay, quick thank you to Jeff and Andrew for the presentation. Open up to questions if anyone's got any questions. There's microphones on the side. I really don't quite know what happens with the text, but if you've got questions, you can always go old-fashioned and hop in front of a microphone. Just to kick off, you talked about Guardian of Sustainability, Jeff. What do you see as the biggest risks to sustainability?
Failure to guard it? Oh, I don't know. I think it's almost a non-question. Sorry, Ty, because all kinds of things go wrong. You know, you've got this complicated system, lots of interactions. Lots of things can go wrong.
Right, so it's keeping an eye on everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I think to me that's where the specialist skill set becomes important, that the regulator does need to understand how the market works to be able to guard against all those things. You need to know which spots to look at and when. It's not just a matter of sitting there waiting for someone to tell you something's wrong.
Okay. Peter's on his way to a microphone. Peter?
I'm on the wrong side. Jeff, I have one question. You talk about centralised data. One of the key issues I think regulators have to deal with around data is not having a central repository, because most do, but is how much detailed data should they be collecting? Now, I guess I have a view, having been around regulators and around this industry for 30 years, that the regulator probably should capture probably not quite as much as an insurer would need, but not far from it. Because I find that there are so many questions the regulator gets from politicians, media, etc., and they can't answer it unless they have the detailed data. So that's the first question. The other part is, I think there's actually a really important role for regulators around guiding the claimant and the premium payers through the system. Now, on the claimant side, and this is, I think, a much bigger issue in CTP schemes, it is a very complicated process. Now, claimants can go to lawyers, fine, but outside that, who's actually going to guide them through the process? So I actually think there's a very important role for the regulator to actually guide and educate the claimant through the process.
First one on data. Technology is a wonderful thing these days, and I mean, we're all stuck with our different bits of legacy and stuff like that, but you can be a little more ambitious, in particular the transaction level and provider level data, how many services, who provides them, which doctors you go to. I think all of that's well within reach. Of course, if you're a monopoly scheme, you've got it. You are that. And some of those are very, very good at using the full extent of that data. If you're in a competitive scheme, it's a bit tougher. But also have a protocol. Have a protocol set up where if you need to go and get some more stuff from an insurer, you do it. You don't have to fight over it for a year and a half before it happens. So, yeah, so Peter, I'm pretty much in favour of more granular. Fraud detection, growing issue all around the country, probably. And that's something that's got to be done across insurers, not within an individual insurer. Do you want to speak to the other one, Andrew? Because I've forgotten the question.
Guiding people through the system. I tend to agree, Peter, as well, particularly if you can get to that place where the regulator holds dispute resolution as one of their functions, that actually navigating the person through and hopefully avoiding having to end up in the dispute resolution path, but giving them the information that helps them understand, create the expectations, know how things work.
Look, I'm going to disagree.
I know you're the opposite.
Yeah. I'm really, really, really ambivalent about that, because what the individual person needs is an advocate. It's somebody who's going to be on their side and help them. And that doesn't have to mean a lawyer, but they need an advocate. And the regulator cannot be an advocate for any individual part of the system. They've got to be that impartial. So I'd like to see some alternative forms of advocacy available, which do drift down to navigation. And there's a starting point in the regulator, clearly, to provide sort of initial information and navigation.
Yeah, perhaps it's semantics, but I do believe that the system is complicated, and there is a need for people to have access to that information without the advocacy function first.
Yeah, but you look on someone's website and it's all legal gobbledygook, isn't it?
And that's why you need access to someone that can help you navigate through that.
Correct. One of the benefits of having two speakers from the same organisation is the level of agreement, but we'll leave that one for a bit later on. At the microphone down there.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Michelle Reynolds from Western Australia. You spoke briefly about culture, and that's a very interesting challenge for us. We have some major insurers who many have their head offices in the east or overseas, and we are noticing, with economic conditions changing, some of our very collegiate cultures are shifting, and the influences of the east are coming across the border. And I've had more conversations with our insurers about expectations around behaviour than I have ever. And on every occasion it's been explained to me it's our East Coast officers who are doing such things or behaving in such a way. So I'm very interested, what sort of influences, as you say, we can best cajole. So what other things are in our toolkit to influence this East Coast influence?
Bastards. You can't trust them, can you? These bloody Easterners. Look, direct relationships with the bosses from the East Coast. That's what I reckon. I mean, the big insurance companies, and we're mostly talking about the sort of five or six big ones, we know who they are, they all have head office workers' comp person, head office statutory classes function. That person's generally quite senior, generally at reporting level to the CEO. Direct relationship with them. Get them all over once a year. If you want a license here, part of the deal is that once a year all the top people visit here and we sit around with them as well as their state people. Go to the top. Follow the money.
I come to Adelaide a bit, and one gentleman I deal with always refers to the wise men from the east. I think it's I take it seriously,
but and women.
It's a bit tongue in cheek. From Western Australia, it's even further. Another question. I might just make this last one if we.
Alan Clayton. Firstly, it's more of a comment on the question of culture. Key one is influencing employer culture, because we know from the Michigan Disability Prevention Study and onwards that the strongest correlate for early and sustained return to work is the nature of the employer culture. The key question, though, is you mentioned in one sentence, right people in right place. I think in my experience over 3.5 decades, what characterises the really good regulators is the breadth and depth of the expertise within the organisation, and particularly in the managed scheme jurisdictions. I mean, the Victorian scheme shouldn't work and didn't work between 1985 and 1992. The reason it did work was because what Len Boehm and Shane O'Day and the others put in place of a really sophisticated regulatory mechanism. So I think the bringing the right people, sustaining them, is an absolute key element of strong regulator and maintaining a sustainable scheme.
Any comment?
Thank you, Ari.
Yeah. Nicole, last question.
It's a bit awkward with this. So my question's for Jeff, and there was a little bit of reference made this morning to national regulators and sort of combining schemes. I'd be interested in your view. What is your view in terms of having one national regulator for, say, workers' compensation?
Nirvana. Wishful thinking, it ain't going to happen. The state owns the law. The state has to own the regulator.
And you don't believe that can change?
Not until we have a national scheme, in which case we could have a national regulator. No, I don't.
Or another constitution.
Yeah. It's a long, long way away.
I was wanting to run for state parliament once on a platform of abolishing state parliaments, and I was told it wasn't... Don't waste my time.
The first ACT government had 4 people from the No Self-Government Party on the first time they opened up. What I might do, give, if everyone give them a round of applause.